Welcome. I'm Larry Olson. And what's on your mind? Once set, it delivers your life. To change the outcomes we want, we must change the plays we're running. Join us at Mindset Playbook with real people, real talk, for real insight.
Today's episode is sponsored by Apernio, an achievement acceleration company whose approach to professional development enables clients to gain insights and perspectives to live, work, and engage with more success.
I want to welcome everyone to the Great Automotive Experience, where we discuss what it takes to make the experience of buying a vehicle meet or exceed the thrill of owning a new one. Now, my guest today is Chet Parsons, who is a part of the future in the automotive evolution, which is happening now. From an early start on the front lines of automotive retail, Chet has followed the industry's evolution through and is now developing sales operations and defining customer journey in the EV industry. With time spent at Tesla, Faraday Future, and most recently Bollinger Motors, his vision is to streamline and improve the customer experiences at all levels to parallel the efficiency and future growth of electric mobility. Welcome, Chet, to the Great Automotive Experience.
Thanks, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
You bet. And it's a pleasure to have you. Chet, let's start out with your journey in the automotive business and ask you why you left the internal combustion world and moved to electric to begin with.
Sure. It was a pretty clear idea for me to move. And it wasn't so much that it was just going to EV and going to electric as it was going to a new method or new direction or new vision of how we sell and how we interact with the customer. Honestly, when I left in the internal combustion side and went to EV and went to Tesla in 2013, it was primarily because of the direct-to-consumer model. Which has proven to be a bigger challenge than I think a lot of people expected. But that idea, and I met very early on, before I had even taken a position with Tesla, with George Blankenship. George was involved with Microsoft and with Apple and created the Apple Store models and developed that type of retail before going to Tesla and helping to build what has become Tesla's direct-to-consumer sales model and is largely referred to in the industry now as the Tesla model, because they're the only one to have successfully accomplished that, because they were starting from a clean slate, because they weren't saddled with existing franchises and dealers. And I saw that as an opportunity to really be part of the evolution of the industry and the change in the industry. The frustrations I'd had in the internal combustion world, so to speak, before were at the dealer levels. It was dealers that had old notions or old methods, even the more progressive dealers that were trying hard, but were having a tough go of it. And I saw this window and I saw what George was doing. I saw what Tesla was doing. And I really believed in that, because it allows, the real core of it is that it allows the manufacturer, it allows the OEM, the company that builds the car and has the vision, to maintain that brand vision feel and carry that through the entire customer journey. And there's a lot of challenges there. There are a lot of places where Tesla had difficulties meeting that customer journey expectation, and they've learned, and it's a constant learning process when you have so many different issues to overcome there. But I think it's still going to be, if not completely overtaking the auto industry, it's at least going to be the preferred method for new non-legacy OEMs, Tesla, Rivian, Lucid, for example, and others that are coming in, to follow through. That really was the bigger push. And I think EV not only made sense from a standpoint of going from internal combustion to electric for efficiency and environmental considerations, but also because these new manufacturers that were embracing that had a leg up on the legacy OEMs to create this new customer journey with a direct-to-consumer model. And it's theirs to make or break. But I think that's an important way going forward for OEMs of that size, for these new OEMs who have those ambitious, scale plans, like you know, like Tesla, like Rivian, like Lucid, for example. I you know, don't want to mention those too many times, but those are the three that are actively manufacturing, delivering, and working with that direct-to-consumer model.
Yeah, you know, and we've, if you go through a mall, you'll now see different manufacturers out there, right? Now, you talked about the fact that it was a much different experience than the traditional dealer model was able to deliver. What were the differences that you saw made the biggest difference?
For me, the initial feel, that initial step of going from education to purchase, you don't have that disconnect between the company that's making this car and designing this vision of the future or designing this, you know, this thing, this object that you want, and then going to the dealer and having the disconnect between seeing this beautiful, say it's a OEM, legacy OEM manufacturer, Porsche. We'll use Porsche, for example. It has a beautiful website, has, you know, all these great images, great video, great content. And then you go to the dealer and they've done a very good job at making sure their dealers look the same, have that consistency, but it's still a dealership. It still has the staffing. It still has the finance office. It still has the traditional, you walk in, you do the dance and the song and everything. And it's improved at the premium levels. Dealers like, you know, or OEMs like Porsche are demanding more of their dealers. They're creating brand ambassadors. They're having people that's job it is, you know, specifically to educate customers and making that process feel more premium and differentiating from, say, a Toyota or a GM store. Mm-hmm. That's easier to do when you have control of the whole operation, when you're taking it from the education on the website all the way through to after sales service and disposition at the end of your ownership. You have those touch points can remain the same and they can have that branded feel, and you can make the customer feel more a part of the brand, which I think will help with brand loyalty, and it'll keep people more comfortable with the process from day one. If you're more comfortable with the purchase experience, you're going to be more comfortable with the service experience. If you're more comfortable with service, you'll be more comfortable coming back and buying again. So it's the entire life cycle customer journey, you know, from that education point to the disposition at the end of the life of the vehicle.
Okay. It seems like the evolution that has been attempted to be accomplished within the internal combustion world or the traditional dealership model has been eliminating the negotiation side of it. Mm-hmm. And I think whether you're getting a great deal or not, the fact that you're negotiating can always make you feel as a customer that you're leaving something on the table, or where are they making the money on me? And it's interesting, you know, Tesla or whatever electric or EV we're talking about obviously are making money. It just doesn't seem to be the focal point, which I see as a huge difference.
It's definitely less of an issue. And again, taking that middleman out of it, taking that disconnect between the OEM and the dealership out, you know that the manufacturer was making money when they sold the car to the dealer. That's how they stayed in business. The dealer then had to find a way to make money on you so they could stay in business. And often it was, you know, in the front end, but then also in the service and the back end, which is a whole another part of this discussion. But it's also a simplified piece where if you don't have that disconnect, you don't introduce somebody new into the equation, you have that trust in the brand, you're more likely to be comfortable with paying a fixed price to Tesla or Rivian or Lucid or GM or Ford or whoever. Mm-hmm. It really has that, okay, this is how the process is going to work. This is what the price is. And we're going to keep you in-house the whole time, as opposed to this is what we say the price is. Good luck with the dealer. They can do whatever they want. And now, you know, it's charging over MSRP for, you know, restricted availability vehicles. And it's taking that out of the equation makes people more comfortable and more likely to be comfortable with the pricing. So I think it also makes in the back of your mind, I think also people think, great, you're selling it to me for this price. You're probably not trying to make more than you were selling it to the dealer. So I'm getting a better deal because I'm not paying that dealer markup. Whether that's the case or not, that's the perception. And I think that that's takes some of the stress out of the buying process, which is, mm-hmm. again, to the end of making this whole thing consistent, that's a big piece of the puzzle.
And what kind of challenges has the EV industry faced kind of along the way and on trying to be as seamless as they can in the process?
Sure. The biggest single challenge in the U.S. is the fact that out of 50 states, and I'll have to go back and check my numbers, but I believe it's still 32 states that don't outright allow direct-to-consumer sales by an OEM, where you have to have a dealer franchise in order to sell, or there's some restrictions on how you can do it. So being able to have the process be the same in Texas as it is in California is impossible, because Tesla can have a dealer license in California. They can't have one in Texas, which, you know, funny enough, even though they're building vehicles there and building batteries in Texas now, moving their headquarters to Texas, they still can't sell a car in Texas legally direct to the consumer. Those are the biggest challenges. I mean, flat out, that's the biggest thing that we face, is that it's different state by state, and that there are so many restrictions from that legacy model of the dealer franchise.
Is that the NADA and their lobbyists that are instrumental in that, or?
It's NADA, it's states, it's individual dealers that have, you know, there are dealers that have major, you know, major holds on real estate and on business in certain areas where they may own multiple dealerships and other properties and racetracks and whatever in their city where it happens to be the capital of a state. You know, there are a lot of things that play into that. And there's a number of dealers that are very interested in it as well. And they're excited about EV. They want to sell a Tesla. They want to sell a Rivian, because they want to be involved with that next step of the industry and of automotive history, you know, as it progresses.
Yeah.
But they're being shut out. And so some of those people are getting upset that they're getting shut out, and they're making it more difficult. And even at the state level, you know, there was a, you know, Texas, I hate to pick on Texas, I worked there for many years. Ford Tesla, as a matter of fact, experienced a lot of this firsthand. Texas had and may still have a special incentive for EVs. It's an additional, I think it was an additional $2,500 tax credit in the state of Texas, or rebate, or however it was set up. What that tax, that credit was set up with a caveat, and it was, you buy a new EV from a manufacturer and you get this extra $2,500, but it has to be purchased through a Texas dealer. So Teslas all of a sudden were missing out on this extra $2,500 incentive, because they were franchise free, and only the dealer franchises were selling. You know, in essence, it was, you know, Nissan Leafs at that point were the only things that applied, that they were getting that benefit and Tesla was not. So the state was kind of subtly, backhandedly favoring their dealers and their in-state business, and, you know, kind of giving the middle finger to Tesla a little bit, which is, again, comes full circle. Now they're building their cars there. So it's, it, you know, those are the, like I said, that is inherently the biggest challenge. I think once we get past that, there are other challenges, as with any sales process, that are really about doing it better, doing it right, and making that process laid out, having that roadmap in place to start from the very get-go. And it's easier when you're starting from scratch with a new brand, new stores, new people, new customers, and you can create that journey. You can build that. And that's kind of the field I'm in now, is taking all of the separate pieces of that sales process, from the production and the ordering, the website, the education, the service, the after sales, the disposition, the leasing, the financing, the actual sales transaction process, all of those pieces, and putting them together in, you know, I say a roadmap, but it's going to have a lot of, you know, different veering paths and different places to go, you know, kind of a choose your own adventure. But for that journey, from the time you find out about that product to the time you have purchased, serviced, and then traded in or sold or turned in on lease, the vehicle at the end of the term. So that has fraught with little challenges, or smaller challenges than just facing legislation and states. And that's where you can really make or break that experience.
What fantastic insights we are getting into in this episode. If this resonates with you and is provoking and of value, please consider the best-selling book of Get a Vision and Live It by your host, Larry Olson, at LarryOlsonLive.com. Thousands of our listeners have found tremendous value from Larry's book, which has been an inspiration to Mindset Playbook's guests. You'll find everything you need to live the best version of your life while accomplishing things now that were once only imagined. The results you'll get will absolutely amaze you. Find the book at LarryOlsonLive.com. And now let's get back. You won't want to miss what's to come on this episode of Mindset Playbook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a work in progress. I have a Tesla, and I got it a little over a year ago, and there's no spare tire, which is, you know, no big deal until your tire goes flat. And then I go to my app, and they can get me in 2 weeks. And so, you know, and it's like, what? And that's the only way you can get to the dealer or get to the service is through the app.
Right.
And there's nothing about it's, you know, it's flat. Where you would think that would be a sense of urgency and the mobility side of it would come out and take care of you. So I think it probably has a lot to do with user error on my part, maybe not understanding how the system works enough. But I just got frustrated and ended up having to go to a discount tire and they had to order it in. And, you know,
flat tires were, and this is from having been in the operation side and working in a service department and seeing what the service advisors were dealing with, which was so many flat tires. Model S in particular was with the 21-inch wheels was every pothole ate a tire, and it's big, heavy car, high performance tires, low profile, you know, 21-inch wheels, and it carried over. And that's been one of the number one complaints from Tesla owners is that the tires are a weak spot in their mind. And part of it is because, you know, a lot of people haven't dealt with that before. If you're coming from a Prius or a Subaru or a Honda or a Mercedes or whatever, most likely you haven't experienced that before. But Teslas, because they're higher performance vehicles, have that more. The guys who came in and they were also Porsche owners who had exotics were like, oh yeah, this happens on my Porsche or my BMW all the time. This isn't, you know, par for the course. I have a tire guy, you know, that deals with these things. Tesla was working on mobile service options with vans. And in the Bay Area, they had these vans that were just tire. They would come out and do your tires in the van with a spare, with mounting and everything. And they could do it on the side of the road. That is going to become more necessary to keep customers because that challenge in particular is once you've created that ecosystem, once you've created that customer journey where when you buy a Tesla, you start at a Tesla website or in a Tesla gallery, you go through that gallery, you go through their sales process, you go through their service center, their delivery center, everything is within that Tesla ecosystem. So when you're ready to do a tire, the first thing you're going to do is exactly what you did, is go to that app. And if that app isn't set up correctly, or if the resources aren't provided correctly, then it makes it a less than satisfactory customer experience. And you have to go outside of the ecosystem, which is what everybody wants to avoid. In theory, it should be easier with EVs because you're not scheduling oil changes. You're less likely to have as many warranty claims. The cars still break. They still have service needs. They still need tires. They still need brakes. They still need brake fluid, coolant. All those things are still requirements, even though they're less and they're less frequent. That service side has to be in place. And that's one of the trickiest things. And I think that was one of the weak links with Tesla has been is that they didn't plan. I couldn't plan. It grew so fast that dealing with, you know, who knew when the first Model S came out, it's like, great guys, we need to have a tire program in place and have mobile service for this because in 10 years, when we hit, you know, year 10, because that's where they are with Model S now, when we hit year 10, tires are going to be a big thing. And that's where we're going to make and break customers. And it's, you know, there have been a number of, again, having, you know, been on the front lines with this, there were a lot of tire issues with Tesla, you know, even going to, you know, more impact resistant 19-inch Goodyears, but then they put foam in them to make them quieter and the foam was separating and things, all these little things that you have to be able to consider. So when you start talking about that customer journey, it's not this straight line. It's not this straight process of go to the website, buy the car, own it, turn it in when you're ready and buy a new one. It's okay, own the car, tires blown through no fault of your own, through a pothole, through a bad tire. What now? You know, and then you've got this diverging branch of how do you get the service? Where do you get the tire? Who keeps it? Parts are an issue. You know, when you have special tires that are a specific size for your Model Y, that's not the same size as what you get on a Camry, then your discount tire doesn't carry it. You know, they don't have that in stock.
Or you wait 4 or 5 days. And it changes.
Yeah. You know, we had spare tire and wheel programs where we would send roadside assistance out and put a bright red Tesla wheel with a good tire on it on your Model S or Model X or Model 3 or whatever. And you would drive on that while we waited for a tire to come in. When the tire came in, it'd get mounted and balanced, put on your wheel and ready to go. And then it'd get bolted to the car and we'd take the spare back. And that worked. But then you have to have an inventory of spare wheels and tires. How many do you have for a certain region? How many roadside assistance guys, mobiles? it snowballs very quickly when you take on everything as the OEM and you don't rely on the dealer. So it requires more effort. It's a bigger group of challenges that you have to be prepared to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think any kind of a new experience is you can do all the forecasting and future development and still miss some things. Mm-hmm. I know when the first challenge I had with the tire, which was the same tire, we were living in Phoenix, and that afternoon a mobile came up and ended up plugging it because it was able to. And then then it was started to lose pressure a little bit. And that's when we ultimately got to the point where I was tired of filling it up every week with it. And so we ended up going and trying to find the tire. And it was interesting though, the challenge now, when you go to a third party, and there's nothing wrong with discount tires, but there's a knowledge issue there.
Right.
And I said, did you notice that it was leaking? It goes, the reason it wasn't holding air is it's got foam in it. And I'm thinking that just from a logical perspective, that's got nothing to do with it. But if you don't know anything, now you're upset about the foam, which is cutting the noise factor down, which you benefit from. But, you know, I think anything now, this has got to be really helpful for you having gone through this, though, in your new adventures with what value you bring to these companies. What have you seen in some of these newer organizations that are getting now into the market about how they're looking at some of these things that are going to happen down the road?
Kind of looking at some of the other brands that have followed, you know, from what Tesla did, we'll start there. We'll start with Tesla. You know, what I saw in my time there was that I, working adjacent to the service team, could see how many more mobile technicians they were setting up, how many more vehicles, resources they were putting towards that to take away the burden on the service centers, which was great because the service centers were woefully underprepared, especially in markets like where I was in Dallas, Texas, which was a huge service center and one of the top five delivery centers in the United States. Even though Tesla in Dallas didn't have as many cars as, say, Los Angeles had like seven delivery centers, Dallas had one. So they were dealing with an incredible volume of cars. When they created the mobile service, customer satisfaction was much better because for simple things, wiper blades, a tire, a software update that froze, any little thing, you could send somebody out and they could do it in their driveway. They didn't have to go in. It could happen while they were out of town and somebody could be left. They didn't even have to be left the keys. Somebody could be given a code to get in. It was a huge, huge change. And decentralizing your service like that was ideal. And I think there's a combination of that. You still have to have a workshop for bigger pieces. If you're dealing with 1,500 and 2,000 pound battery packs, you're going to have to do that in a service center with the right resources. But for the little things, and it's that has affected how the legacy manufacturers are servicing now. The last time I had to service my wife's Mercedes, we called the dealer and I made an appointment. And they called me back 2 hours later and said, hey, we see what service you're due for. It's not as big as you thought. We can do that in your driveway and we can do it a day sooner. Great. Beautiful. Yeah. We both work from home. It's like, this is ideal. Come on in the driveway. And they did. They showed up in a little Metris. They had popped out. They changed the oil and did all the stuff, everything done in the driveway. And the guy was gone in an hour and a half, 2 hours. Yeah. And we didn't have to leave the house. I didn't have to get a loaner car. They created they reduced their demand for the resources of loaner cars and rental cars and staff at the dealership by putting this one guy in a van with the right tools he needed. And they took the burden off of their service center. So Tesla has done a good job at that. Mobile service is big. Still friends with former colleagues from Tesla that are still doing mobile service. And there are areas where there are no service centers. And for good reason, there's not enough density of customers. But they still have a resource. They still have somebody there who's equipped with, a transit connect that can go out and do small services. But he also has a friend of mine who's in Colorado. He'll go in. He's got a Ford pickup and a trailer if he needs to go pick a car up and bring it in. That level of service is great. But that gets expensive and hard to replicate when you're talking about a $45,000 or $50,000 Model 3 or Model Y versus a $100,000 Model S or Model X. So being able to scale that level of service, which is that customer service that people are beginning to expect from Mercedes, from Lexus, from Porsche. They want that in their daily cars, in their mainstream cars. And mainstream and daily right now in EV space is still 50 grand. You know, you're still talking about a premium price point car. So you have to be able to scale that level of service to the, you know, to the volume that you're going to sell to keep that premium experience. So it becomes a bigger expense and resources and burden, but at the same time, you can control it. So it's a double-edged sword in some ways. You know, you have this benefit, but it's going to cost you and it's going to take more work.
Yeah, with the challenge that a lot of organizations are having, not only from COVID, but just the mass resignation or re-inspiration or, you know, whatever you want to call it. Are you finding that finding people to drive these mobile and having the technological insights to be able to do the service, has that been an issue? Getting the personnel?
It is. It can be. And I saw a lot of guys come to Tesla in the service side, in particular, good skilled technicians, people who were master technicians at Audi or Mercedes or Porsche or Ford, you know, diesel mechanics. And I saw guys that excelled and worked up and worked their way through the company. And I saw guys that got frustrated because they weren't making as much money as they were when they were a master tech in an Audi store and ended up going back because it just wasn't as lucrative. The younger guys who are coming in who are excited about it and want to do something new haven't tasted that. They don't want the stress of that. They want to know what their life is going to be like, and it's a little easier. And there's still room to grow, and you maybe get stock options. You maybe get some sort of equity. You maybe get some other benefits that you wouldn't get in a traditional dealer environment. And also some of the older guys who are tired of that grind were coming in and be like, this is where I want to retire. They're like, I want to pick up a little equity. I want to be here where it's a little quieter. I don't want to deal with the politics of working in a traditional legacy OEM service center. And so you get both levels of skill. And it's great because the younger guys come in, and when you're talking about, great, here's how you're going to fix this car. Put down all your wrenches and screwdrivers. Don't touch anything. Don't put the car in a lift. Take this cable, go plug it into the car, plug the other end into your laptop, and go through this code, essentially. Go through this service program to figure out what's wrong with the car, beyond what you do with an OBD2 scanner. But as more, you know, as you do more centric software issues, the younger guys were picking that up and running with it. And I had guys who were going through the logs for these cars to find these strange problems. And a couple of those guys have moved on to developing the autopilot systems or developing battery technology or testing batteries. You know, they've moved up into that because they embraced it. So I think it's going to be tricky to find enough people, but I think the people are out there who are excited about it, especially at the age where they'll be looking for those careers. And I think on the sales side, that happens as well. You don't necessarily want the guy who's been like me for selling cars in a dealership for 20 years before they get into this. You might want to find the people who are younger that you can train and bring up. The hard part is they have no background with automotive and they don't know what they're competing against, and they don't know what a finance rate looks like, or they don't know how a lease is calculated and things like that. So there's a lot of education that has to be done on the sales side, which is what the legacy OEMs are figuring out. Their guys may know how to do the finance side. They may know how to sell a car, and they may understand how that works, but they don't know how an EV works, and they don't know how you're going to charge it. And they don't want to know. They don't care, because that's two cars out of 200 that they might sell at a dealership in a month right now. That will change.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Well, with the time we have remaining, there's a lot of people out there that, love their car, even though gas prices keep rising and everything else. And then, you know, they kind of complain about the fact that, well, it takes you sometimes 40 minutes to 50 minutes to charge your EV when you're on a trip. And, but if they're connected, they can watch Netflix. I mean, they can enjoy the time. They can take a nap. I mean, it's you can really blend it into making it a different kind of journey. Mm-hmm. But that's the future. I think there's California that's going to be completely free of combustion by 2035, or at least they threw that out there.
Yeah. So no new internal combustion cars to be sold in the state after 2035.
Okay. Okay. So it's still going to be years before we fleshed it all out. But what excites you the most about the whole EV industry, and why should anyone out there who's driving an internal combustion engine care?
I go back way back to when the Chevy Volt came out. Jay Leno was a big fan, and people were like, "Oh, but you've got hundreds of old gas cars and things that smell like oil and leather. Why would you care about electric cars?" And his rationale was, this is great because the less of these resources we burn up for the future cars, the more we have available to appreciate the older cars and the less it'll be required. So if we can reduce the need, not necessarily eliminate the need for petroleum and gasoline and things like that, we can have that appreciation for the vintage cars and the old cars. And I'm not unique in the EV industry in that my daily driver right now is gas powered. I don't have an EV yet. And there will be a time very soon, probably, that will change. But my impetus for having an EV is I want that appliance. I want that usable car that's simple, that I get in, I unplug it, I go in the morning. And it's basically akin to my phone. It's a device. It's a mobility device as opposed to a mobile device. But that gives me the convenience, the comfort to go sit in traffic on the 405, to go somewhere, to be comfortable and to have everything I need for that basic function of transportation, but in a way that's more pleasant, more ecologically friendly. I charge at home. It's going to be mostly for, you know, around town. Yeah. Because I also want to have something in my garage that smells like oil and gasoline and leather that I can go use on, you know, once a week or once a month or twice a month. And I'll be consuming a lot less. I may not make it to 0-0, but I'm be consuming a lot less and still enjoy that old feel when I can. But the EV would allow that to be more plausible, more, you know, more available, because those resources aren't being eaten up by every car on the road. They're still available for these other cars. And hopefully with synthetic fuels and things that come, that becomes a more environmentally friendly hobby. For my old, you know, gas guzzling, oil spewing, polluter in the, you know, my vintage car, which I'll say I'm recycling and reusing, but it's the EV is where I enjoy an EV is when driving isn't fun, when you're sitting in traffic, when you're stop and go, when you are just running the air conditioner and looking at bumpers in front of you and taillights. And then for, you know, when you talk about the long distance, you just have to plan. And you know, I've driven from when I lived in the Midwest as a younger man, I drove from Peoria, Illinois to Alaska in a Jeep Wrangler. It had a reasonable sized fuel tank, but I put a jerry can on the bumper and was prepared to know, you know, and watched, because when you're driving on the Alcan through Western Canada, there's not a lot of gas stations. So you planned ahead, you planned for that. You planned your trip around that. Yeah. And it was still a wonderful trip. You know, it was still great. Around town, that's not an issue. When you do a long trip like that, with the number of fast charging options that are coming up, the expansion, the rapid expansion of public charging networks, it's going to be less and less of an issue.
Yeah.
The last road trip I took, we drove cross country. We drove from Los Angeles area to Denver, Colorado. And we took it fairly leisurely. We took the dog with us. And when we stopped, we would go for a walk and take the dog. It's like plenty of time to throw 20 or 30 minutes of a fast charge in an EV and move on. Because then later on, we still stopped for gas. You know, it was multiple stops. And if you plan accordingly, and they're popping up everywhere. We went to, not last year, in 2020. This is, you know, a year and a half ago now. My team came out from Bollinger and we took our B1 prototype on a private event in the Mojave Desert out near California City. And we were in Mojave, California. You could see the airplane graveyard. And we found a public charging outlet at the CHP office. And I was like, this is great. We can charge for free here in the middle of the desert, right off of the main freeway. And then I saw next door that the Best Western or some little hotel, again, in the middle of nowhere here, had a 6-bank Electrify America, and it was all fast charge. It was varying levels of CCS fast charge plus a CHAdeMO, and it was brand new. And right there, you could fast charge in that area and have, you know, plenty. So they're popping up in places. And I think as, you know, as people start to see that that's a viable option, they'll start to recognize that that's not the big pain in the butt that they think it's going to be.
Yeah.
And really, then it all comes back around to controlling that narrative and having the input from step one, where you can educate your customers and, you know, let them know that this isn't going to be an issue before they ever get in the EV, before they say, oh, I bought this EV, I bought this Mach-E from my Ford dealer. They said I could charge anywhere. I'm driving to, you know, Seattle. where do I charge? How do I charge? What do I do? You know, and not have that education. Tesla was able to do that with the superchargers and make it simplified. And it's great, except that, you know, then you limit your functionality, and hopefully that will switch over like they are in Europe, where anybody can charge on a supercharger. You know, that's going to be more publicly available and a little less, you know, keep it to themselves. But as EVgo, Electrify America, Greenlots, all of these companies that are coming up that are building out these massive networks and getting the support of OEMs, you know, they are, with the Volkswagen group behind Electrify America, they have to have that, especially as they are introducing new EV after new EV after new EV. I think there's like four in the Audi lineup alone right now. So you have that growth. And I think that that's going to make it, you know, very soon to where it's a lot less of an issue. But the key will be educating the buyer so that they know and that they can get over that. They can overcome that challenge. And that's what sales is about, is overcoming the objections. And, you know, kind of full circle to that is how you sell these vehicles results in how they get used, and how you educate people on how to use them results in how you sell them. So I think, like I said, it all comes full circle. Everything is part of the sales journey, from charging to service to your tires to the website to the transaction. Everything is part of that customer journey, and it's all part of being able to sell and retain your client. And that's what the goal is.
Yeah. You know, the one thing I didn't hear you share, which is what excites me the most, is when I step on the pedal and ability to pass and the ability to, you know, not be grinding it out. And unless you're in a, you know, a very expensive sports car, there's nothing more wonderful than having that kind of exhilaration and yet the control as well. And do you see ultimately a universality and ability to charge?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's coming now. I think Tesla is having to do that in Europe, where the CCS2 standard is mandated. So they have to have both charging outlets on all of their cars. And they have to have the supercharging stations have to be compatible. Gotcha. Tesla's really the biggest holdout, just because they have the highest volume of cars with a proprietary connector. Rivian, Lucid, Ford, GM, you know, VW, everybody else is using a standardized, you know, the SAE standardized outlets. Yeah. And the communication standards are getting there. They're in place, and now it's just a matter of making sure all the cars can communicate with the chargers, because the chargers are all on standard now. And it will be, I think, you know, we'll start to see the phase out of things like the proprietary connectors for Tesla. And I think even CHAdeMO will probably phase out a little bit, maybe not in Asia right away, but in the US and in Europe, where it'll become less and less common. But, you know, like I said, that Electrify America charger I saw in the middle of the desert had both. And it's easy enough. The power comes out of the ground, and the cable on the end of it's the only thing you have to change, and the communication protocols. So it's easy enough to meet all of those standards. And, you know, out of six chargers, there was one CHAdeMO. So, I mean, to give you an idea of, you know, what the take rate is on that, you know, that's there. You know, I think that the standardization of it is coming, and it's, like I said, I think it's growing at a rate now where it won't be this big objection that it currently is in the next couple of years. I think people are going to get comfortable with it pretty quickly.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, you are a wealth of information, and I would end up just continuing to fire questions at you regarding my interest, which I'm not going to do, but I really want to thank you for taking your time and allowing us to really get in chat to what goes on to make that customer experience its best it could possibly be. And nothing's perfect. And, you know, what should I have done with that, having a flat tire? Should I have made a call or something to Tesla? I mean,
it all depends on where you are as far as what Tesla's current resources are available in your area. And this is, you know, as someone who's been in the business for so long and less so out here, just because I haven't had the need for it. But I used to have a tire guy. I was one of those people, just because I've been a car guy for so long, and I've had sports cars and cars with unique tire needs. I've always had a tire place, like, be familiar with them. And, you know, it is being able to educate yourself a little bit on the tires and, you know, get on the forum. One of the things that Tesla has had in droves that has been a really good resource, can be super annoying at times as well, especially when you're working at Tesla, is the forums and the community around the cars and the excitement around them, the early adopters, the people who are really drinking the Tesla Kool-Aid. The downside is it can get a little tiring, but the upside is they're a huge resource because somebody will have gone through that problem before. Somebody will have had that exact same scenario or something very, very close. And they can say, oh yeah, by the way, when you go to Discount Tire, they don't understand the foam. Just be aware of that. You know, they'll be able to have had that experience, and the educational resources that are there are fantastic. And part of that is because, not to go too far off the rails here, but part of that is because Tesla built a brand and they kept it in-house with the website, the sales, the transaction, the dealership, the galleries, everything is Tesla branded. And that's created this brand loyalty that you don't get with a lot of other things, because you may be loyal to a dealer. In the old days, you'd go to your local dealer and maybe they were a GM dealer. Maybe they got out of the GM business or they got rid of their Cadillac franchise and they said, oh, but our Lincoln store is next door if you want a nice thing. And that's how you buy the cars you bought. Now you say, oh, I'm a Tesla buyer now. And Tesla buyers are very loyal and they'll come back and buy more and more and more. And there's some attrition. There's some people who are like, oh, cool, this Mach-E is a pretty neat thing. It's growing. But Tesla's opened their eyes to EV and let them make that transition more easily. And it hasn't hurt Tesla sales. Yeah. So it's all about using those resources that are there. And customers are a resource too. You know, we can't ignore that. We can't ignore, you know, the creation of a community around a brand. And so that's important as well.
That's a great point. Great point. Well, I thank you again for taking your time. And I think our listeners are going to find this fascinating. I have. All the best to you in your new adventures, and hopefully our paths will cross here, since we're in the same state anyway.
Yeah, let me know if you need a follow up once I get started in the new role. It'll be more fun things to discuss.
All right, I look forward to it. And thank you all. Thank you very much. And thank you, listeners. You could have listened to anything and you chose to listen to us. So I hope you've got a little more insight into the EV side of it, or what you can do when you get a flat tire on your Tesla. But thanks you so much, Chet, and all the best. And we'll look forward to another one.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
All right.
Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, we ask that you please subscribe and share with your friends and associates. On our next fascinating interview, let's delve into the plant medicine benefits with Jonathan DePotter, discussing a variety of journeys one can take to experience peak performance and well-being. Jonathan is the founder of Behold Retreats. If you're ready to accelerate personal and spiritual growth to realize the full transformational benefits of psychedelic medicine in a safe, expertly guided journey in an idyllic location to boot, then you've tuned into the right program.